Dr. Chris Caton is the Chief Economist at BT Financial Group, and he's been there since about 1991. He's also worked in the Treasury, Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, and for a consulting firm. Most importantly, he's retiring very soon. So please welcome Dr. Chris Caton to the stage.
Thank you, Michael. Yes. I think I've been a constant factor at all six of these, but yeah, this will be the last one. I'm retiring actually a month today on the date that just happens to be my 25th anniversary of working at BT. There are, a few people, I've probably told you this before, but there are a few people that have been here 25 years or longer, because among other things, it's not a bad place to work. But of all the people that have been there that long, I have one unique distinction. I'm the only one of those people who's never ever been promoted. So that'll give you some idea of the level of competence we're dealing with. First of all, I hope you've had a better year than I have since we last met. I'm not talking about your life as an investor or my life as an investor so much, but I've had a pretty poor year health-wise. Mainly skeletal, I should say, as opposed to disease-oriented, shall we say. But I guess I was always conscious that there was a Medicare threshold. A level of health spending that once you hit this in the calendar year, it's pretty free. It's free after that, pretty much. I guess I was always conscious of that, but it never meant much because I never got anywhere near it. But last year I did hit it in early December. And after that, immediately you're conflicted because you think, okay, for the rest of the year, my healthcare costs are free. I hope something else goes wrong. but fortunately, nothing did. I'm going to do what I usually do, although I have to say I've got about 50 minutes worth of slides up here and only about 25 minutes to half an hour to present them. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to talk until I've used up the time and then stop. As I said, I'm going to do what I usually do, give you my view of the big picture. I'm going to start with a few words about an event that took place a bit more than 5 weeks ago now, namely the budget. This was the pre-election budget that you have when you're not really having a pre-election budget, just moved a bit of money around. And of course, one of the groups that took money off were wealthy superannuants, and it's what they want to do in the era of superannuation that has become the principal bone of contention. Let me say what I'm about to say is purely my personal view. I am one of the people that are affected by the $1.6 million cap, but I have to be honest and say I'm okay with that. In 2006-07, we set up a number of measures which made superannuation extraordinarily tax effective, and those measures were so big in terms of revenue foregone that they were one day going to be shown to be unsustainable. So something would have to be done one day. The issue, I guess, here's how I see it, that the superannuation system exists basically for people to fund their own retirement. But we made it very tax effective, and as a result, some people use the system to build up their own personal wealth far beyond what they could possibly need for retirement. Now, they were perfectly entitled to do that. The rules allowed them to do that. They did nothing wrong. But the government also is perfectly entitled to say, okay, that's not actually what we meant to happen. We need to amend the rules to bring superannuation back to what it to its original purpose, to enable people to fund their own retirements. Now, you can argue about the detail of what they've done, but we had to do something eventually. And of course, the superannuation concessions cost the government money, and that money doesn't drop like rain from heaven. It's basically paid for by ordinary everyday taxpayers. So I'm glad, I guess, in this debate that I have discovered what the word retrospective means. Retrospective means any measure that has a negative effect on you. That's retrospective, apparently. But enough about that. As I said, that is purely a personal view. But it's been a challenging year so far, hasn't it? It's just as well we're all on holidays in January, because January was an awful month. To this extent, financial markets fell all over the world. The US share market had its worst first 6 weeks ever. The Australian share market fell for the first 6 weeks. They weren't the only things falling. The Australian dollar was falling. Iron ore prices were falling. Oil prices was falling. To this extent that that I write a monthly that I put out religiously on the first day of the month, even when that's a holiday. So on January 1st, because it was January, I had to give my market outlook for the year. Here's what I think is going to happen to the Australian economy. Here's what I think is going to happen to share markets. I put that out on the 1st of January. On the 10th of January, I had to put out a complete rewrite. What happened in the first week made my annual outlook look unachievable. That has never happened to me before. But in late January, preparing to write my February newsletter, I thought, okay, I've got to get my head around this. What has caused this market weakness? And I started to write down causes, and I realized that I was writing down words, all of which began with the letter C. There was concern about growth in China. Tim will tell us a bit more about that later. There was concern about commodities. There was concern about currencies and the possibility of a currency war. There was concern about capital flows from emerging markets to developed markets. That's a safe haven flow, but it doesn't help the country the money's just left. And there was concern about credit spreads. Now, a credit spread is basically the difference between the rate at which companies can borrow and the risk-free government bond rate. And when that blows out, when that increases, it's either because lenders know there's more risk, so they want to be compensated for it, or borrowers are desperate for money, so they're prepared to pay a higher rate. And an increasing credit spread is a pretty good forecaster of bad economic times ahead. Call it recession, if you like. So I wrote down these words, and I was staring at them, and then it dawned on me that these weren't actually the causes of the market weakness. They were symptoms of something else. And it didn't take me long to figure out they were symptoms of an increasing belief in financial markets that the global economy was teetering on the edge, once again, of something pretty ugly. Nothing like 2008-09, that'll probably never happen again in our lifetimes, but let's say just a global economic recession, just an ordinary common or garden one. Or just a period of very, very slow growth, as opposed to the slow growth we just had before. And around about this time, excuse me, I speak to a broker in the United States. His name is Neil. And Neil is a lot smarter than I am. And Neil has a model. And what you put into the model is where financial markets are. What's happened to the US share market? What's happened to credit spreads? And what comes out of the model is the market's perception of a recession in the next 12 months. Now, Neil's work is for the US, and in late January, I was talking with him about this model, and he said, you know, if financial markets have got this right, there's a 60% chance of a recession in the US in the next 12 months. Now, once you've got that number, it's easy, at least in principle. I'm a macroeconomist. I look at financial markets, but I look at consumer spending. I look at labor markets. And I can come up with my own probability. And try as I may, I could never get a probability bigger than about 20%. So you've got financial markets priced as if there's a 60% chance of a recession, and I think the true answer is only about 20. Let's suppose for just one wild, extravagant minute I'm right. What has to happen eventually? Markets have to realise they're wrong, and they will recover. And so I said that in early February, and that's exactly what happened. The US share market, everything turned around about the same time. The US share market turned on the 11th of February, the Australian share market on the 12th, the oil price actually turned in late January, the iron ore price turned around the same time, everything V'd. And certainly the share markets, and pretty much everything else you look at, is back above where it was at the start of the year. So we've got back everything we lost, essentially because markets overreacted, they were too gloomy. Now, while I was talking to Neil, he said, you give a few presentations, don't you? He said, I've got a slide that can help you. Because it shows all these interrelated factors, because they are interrelated. Think about China and commodities, for example. It shows all these interrelated factors and how they affect each other and how they affect financial markets. And he said, I've got this chart. I'll send it to you. You can put it up in front of any audience. It doesn't matter how sophisticated they are or not. And there will be instant enlightenment. They will know exactly what's going on in financial markets and why. And he sent me this. So are there any questions? If you look carefully, actually, and I know you've got a copy of it in front of you, there's a lot there. Last week, we got news that the Australian economy was still growing quite well. 3.1% growth in the year to the... in the year to the March quarter. That's better than any other developed country around the world, that with the possible exception of one of the Scandinavian countries. But it sort of still doesn't feel like it, does it? And that's because although what they call GDP is growing quite well, living standards across Australia are not rising. And yet that's got to be one of the functions of an economy, hasn't it? To increase the standard of living over time. So let's see how well we've been doing there. First of all, how would you do that? What's the single most reliable way to increase living standards over time? Answer: productivity growth. And that's why there's always a focus on that. We call it innovation these days, but it's the same thing. But it turns out that's not the only way. You can also lift your living standards if you're in the lucky position of having stuff that the rest of the world is prepared to pay a lot for and sell you their stuff cheaply. The kindness of strangers effect. And it turns out there is a third way. You can lift living per capita living standards simply by sending a bigger share of the population out to work over time. We did that via female participation. We're not going to be able to do that in the future because the overall population is growing faster than the working age population. The ageing effect. Let's have a look at how those three mechanisms have done in increasing living standards since 1993. If we had just relied on productivity growth, that's what would have happened, the lower line. Living standards would be, let's say, about 43% higher in that period. The gap between the first and the second, that's the kindness of strangers effect. Not much difference until the Chinese start in 2003. The gap peaks in 2011 and then has since come back down because commodity prices have been falling. The gap between the second and third line is essentially this send more and more people out to work effect. Now, you might be surprised how much difference that's made, but just bear in mind that in 1993, when this starts, the unemployment rate was 11%. So just getting unemployment down has helped. But now see the peak just before the GFC in 2008. What that says is, in 15 years, courtesy of these three effects, living standards in Australia on a per capita basis rose by 60%. And half of that came from something other than productivity growth. Since then, you can see the effect of the GFC, and you can see basically living standards in Australia are actually no higher now than they were 8 years ago. So you go from 60% growth in 15 years to nothing in eight. It's going to seem tough, isn't it? And you can see also that line has been coming down for some time. Why? Because the Australian economy is pushing into two massive headwinds. And we've talked about this last year and probably the year before. The downswing in mining capital spending as a share of GDP and, at least as importantly, the downswing in commodity prices. Here are the two massive headwinds. On the right, and that's mining investment as a share of GDP, went from 2 to 7.5 in the China years, now coming back down, not done yet. And incidentally, that upswing, I've looked in our history, I've looked in the history of every other commodity producer for whom I can find data. Nobody's ever had a mining capex boom like the one we had. Nobody. But now we've got the downside of it. But on the left, that limits output growth. But on the left, that tells you even with output growth, we're not getting the income we used to get because commodity prices, as you can see, were rising and have been falling. Incidentally, when I look at that chart also, I reckon that's probably what Clive Palmer's personal wealth looks like. I don't know if it was a very eventful week, budget week this year. Not only did we have the budget, we had a rate cut on the same day. That's never happened before. And the next day, there were two events took place within an hour of each other that I think most people have missed the significance of. Donald Trump became the presumptive Republican nominee for president in the United States. And around about the same time, Clive Palmer announced that he was not going to run again for the seat of Fairfax on the Sunshine Coast. This was shortly after it was announced that, well, he was shown polling that said that if you do run, Clive, you'll actually lose to the informal vote. But I reckon there's a deeper thing going on here. Donald Trump needs a running mate. Clive Palmer's free. Don't you reckon that'd be a dream ticket? I'd vote for that ticket. So if you're pushing into these two headwinds, what can you do? And as policymakers, well, you could expand fiscal policy, but we were starting with a big deficit anyway. Why have we got a deficit that's so big after 24 years of growth? And the answer is, the single biggest answer is because we gave it all away on the upswing. The federal budget is very sensitive to commodity prices. So when this was happening, the money just kept rolling in the door, and the government did its best to shovel it back out again. The temporary commodity price boom financed the 8 successive annual income tax cuts and the superannuation tax concessions and all that middle class welfare and the baby bonus and the bump up to the pensions a few years ago. And then the money, the money stopped coming in, but we're still paying it out. So there's no room really for expansionary fiscal policy. So you turn to monetary policy and you cut rates. And those rate cuts have helped. They may not have helped everybody in this room, but they have helped. We've had an extraordinary boom in residential construction. And also the rate cuts, among other things, have pushed the exchange rate down. And don't underestimate the effects of that. In the past 12 months, exports of educational services have increased by 20%. Exports of tourism have increased by 17%. Those are both exports that you have to come here to get. But that's had an extraordinary effect on activity. So the rate cuts have helped, but where they haven't helped is we haven't yet seen any turnaround in non-mining capital spending. That's the blue line as a share of GDP. The forecast is at least based as much on hope as anything else, but it's the low level of capital spending outside of mining that is the reason why we introduced those small business initiatives last year. We expanded the small business initiatives in the budget this year, and we're planning to expand them further. They're desperately trying to get some non-mining spending going. Why isn't it growing faster than it is? Basically because things have been so slow for so long. The Australian economy, not to the extent that the rest of the world is, but the Australian economy is trapped in something of a self-perpetuating slow growth trap. Now, I know this might come as news to people in Sydney and New South Wales, but outside of New South Wales, the economy is still very sluggish. But what about we're not alone in this. We do this every year. Every number here is a forecast for GDP or economic output growth for this calendar year, 2016. They're not mine. They're put together by panels of economists and analysts around the world. And there are so many numbers here because these panels update their forecasts every month. So here's how you read it. First column, when these panels were asked way back last June, what's Australia going to grow by in 2016? What's New Zealand going to do, etc.? Those were their answers. Last column, the same question, but the answer is given in May this year. Now, you get the stories if you look along the lines. And it makes sense to start at the bottom line. What can you say? Well, pretty much every month, we cut our growth forecast for this year, our global forecast, by a tenth. I actually think this process is close to over, but we won't know that for some time yet. But you know what? This isn't a 2016 story. It happened last year and the year before that. And every year back to 2010, we get kind of halfway through the year and we say, oh, this is another rubbish year, but next year will be better. And we don't get to that better year. It's always yet another year of slow growth. And to me, this is the issue since the GFC. Not that we're going back there, but that we just can't get out of second gear. And as long as that's the case, interest rates will remain low around the world, investment returns will remain low, inflation will remain low. There's still a long way for this story to go, in my view. Now, incidentally, if you looked at Sydney Morning Herald online today or pick up the paper tomorrow, there'll be one more report. It happens pretty much every month. A major global economic organisation, in this case the IMF, I think, gets some media play because it's cut its growth forecast for this year. And in this case, what's in the paper, or what's online today, says the IMF has released a new forecast which says global growth is only going to be 2.4 this year. And that's significantly less than they thought it was going to be in January. And this will be interpreted as doom and gloom. Never, ever, ever pay any attention to those forecasts. And it's not because they're not good. It's just that these organisations, the people are so smart, they don't waste their time forecasting every month. They only forecast every 3 months. So whenever you hear that the IMF or the OECD or the World Bank has cut its growth forecast from what it had 3 months ago. Remember this table. They're just following where everybody else has already gone. And in fact, their forecast is 2.4% growth, which is what everybody else had before anyway. So it's not news. Now, financial markets, when I put this together a few days ago, our currency 72.5, 74.5 today. I've told everyone, I've told you year after year that the Australian dollar was too strong and had to come down. It took me a few years to get that right, but in the end I did. Now it's somewhere close to the right answer, so I no longer have a strong view. As I said, somewhere close to fair value, and I'll show you that in a minute. The cash rate, as I said, they cut on budget day. Now that was an interesting story. The day, throughout the month of April, as I went around the country talking to people, I told everybody who would listen that there was a clear window of opportunity for them to cut rates again in May. The residential property issue that they were worried about a year ago had quietened down, and the window would open wider the lower was the inflation number we got in late April. Then we got that number, and the day before I was polled, along with 50 other economists, and I was one of the 33 of the 51 that said, no, I don't think they will go tomorrow. So I got that wrong. Here's the bizarre thing. 18 of the 51 said the day before, yeah, they'll probably cut. After they cut, 90% of all economists said, oh, and they will cut again. Doesn't that strike you as a bit of a mind shift in a very short period of time? Here's how it happens. Financial market economists have a model that says rate cuts are like cockroaches. There's never just one. I would say right now, given what we found out about the Reserve Bank thinking since then, that it's almost a 50-50 call as to whether they cut again. If they do, it'll be August. So I've got one in here, but I'm not going to die in a ditch about it. The Australian share market up around 53.70 today. It was 47.65 or thereabouts on the 12th of February. So it's been a great 3.5 months, almost 4 months. There's still some potential for upside, but not as great as, certainly not at the pace we've seen it so far. Now here's the currency. This happens occasionally when my slide looked a bit bigger than this, but it's in moving from one machine to the other, it's done this. But the red line is the Australian dollar in US dollars. Look to the right and see the V so far this year. Although I will admit, then it's starting to look a bit like a W. The yellow line is my estimate of fair value. For years we were too strong. Now we're somewhere close to the right answer. Incidentally, if you want to if you want to figure out what's going to move the Australian dollar on a day-to-day basis, here's your biggest single indicator, the iron ore price. there's been an extraordinarily close relationship, as you can see here. No, the V in both of them. this chart's not quite up to date, but even last night, both the currency and the iron ore price went up. On any given day, they will tend to move in the same direction. Now, onto the share market, same problem with the slide. This is an end-of-month chart for the ASX 200. Last point plotted there is the end of May, at which stage we had been up, note the V, at which stage we had been up 3 months in a row, the first time that's happened since February last year. On the 12th of February, as I said, when we were around 47.65, we were down 20% from where we were in April last year. Now, a 20% fall is a bear market, and they don't usually stop at 20. Although this one, I think you can be pretty convinced, did stop at 20. I'll borrow the next slide from Shane Oliver. Shane is the chief economist at AMP, and we chief economists, yeah, we do have our own secret society. We have our own handshake, and I can't tell you too much because then it wouldn't be a secret, would it? But one of the rules of the society is you can borrow each other's slides, particularly when the person being borrowed from never actually finds out you've done it. Shane basically said, okay, I'm going to go back and look in the last 100 years and find all the occasions on which the market fell by 20% or more, how long they lasted on average, what the average fall was. So this was a relatively mild bear market. And the only column that's really still relevant here is the last column, which says when you're in a bear market, once it turns, that's what happens over the next 12 months. The average gain is 30%. Now, I would not be so stupid as to have a 30% forecast here, because by at least one measure, the most conventional measure you ever see, the Australian share market is actually not cheap right now. That most conventional measure is the price-earnings ratio. How many dollars, basically, market participants are prepared to pay for $1 worth of earnings. That's what it looks like. There's your long-run average. We're above the long-run average. So that says, if anything, it's a bit expensive. But without going into the detail, the equilibrium price-earnings ratio will go up when yields elsewhere, i.e. interest rates, come down. And so I'm going to take that line and redraw it and put the cash rate on it. Now, because I want to say the PE will be higher when the cash rate's lower, I've inverted the cash rate. But when you do that, this is what you get. And now, all of a sudden, we don't look cheap, do we? We don't look expensive. If anything, we look a bit cheap given the current level of interest rates. Another way to make the same point is to compare the yields you can make in the share market at its current price level. So this is really the dividend yield, and compare that with interest rates. When you do that, historically they've all been pretty close, but look at the size of the gap now. Right now, your choice, with your franking credits, your choice is put the money in the market, get 6%, or put it in a one-year bank deposit or a 10-year bond yield and get 2 and a bit. As long as that gap is that wide, it is impossible to say that the Australian share market is expensive. If anything, it's looking cheap compared with everything else. Now, coming to some of the factors that matter for the Reserve Bank, one of the reasons why I didn't think they were going to cut rates before, cut rates on the budget day, I had a couple of reasons. One is, when your cash rate's 2% and you're a small open economy and you think there could be a global shock next year, I'd rather keep 2% in reserve than, say, 1.5% in reserve. But the other thing is, we have never before cut rates when the unemployment rate has clearly been trending downwards. And that's the yellow line. That looks to me like it's trending downwards. Does it look like that to you? Certainly doing a lot better than I thought it was going to be a year ago. The red line, incidentally, shows you we are still generating jobs in Australia. Not, of course, in manufacturing or mining, but in the service sector. The second reason why, the overriding reason why the Reserve Bank cut rates is because they actually looked at the inflation figures and decided there's not enough inflation in Australia. We've never done this before. We've never cut rates because inflation was low. We've cut rates because inflation was low enough to let us do it for some other reason. But we've never cut rates simply because inflation was low. Now, you might think, what's wrong with low inflation? But the Reserve Bank looks around the world at the Eurozone and Japan, etc., and sees them caught in something of a disinflation trap. And they decide, we don't want to go there. They actually want a bit more inflation in Australia. And it turns out that the yellow line is what they're targeting. That's supposed to be between 2 and 3. But the red line strips out the volatiles like petrol, calculates underlying inflation, and even that is the lowest it's been since we've been measuring it. So although the yellow line is pushed down by inflation, but because the red line's down, pushed down by petrol, because the red line's down, it's not just petrol. So what else can it be? What is causing widespread low inflation in Australia? Here's a very simple answer: wages. Wage growth in Australia right now, essentially, you'd have to go back to the 1960s to find the last time it was that low. Now, just very quickly on the third issue that the Reserve Bank was worried about last year, certainly, house prices. When they cut rates to 2% in May last year, they knew that they were running the risk of lighting a fire under residential property. They could see evidence of it already. They could see a massive increase in the interest in residential property by domestic investors, and they could see this focused in two cities, and the other one's Melbourne. You know what the first one is. Now, a year down the track, they figure, well, the domestic investors are not showing the interest they were, and that's in part because of the measures they had APRA impose on the banks in the middle of last year. The recent house price information, I have to tell you, has been confusing. But it is still, last year I said it was a tale of two cities. It was massively about Melbourne and Sydney. That turns out still to be the case. These are house prices in thousands of dollars. And there's your first indication that so much of the pressure in the past year or so has been in Melbourne and Sydney, the top two on the left-hand side. If you just look at what happened in the year to the end of May this year by capital city, across the combined capitals, 10%, but it's massively Melbourne and Sydney still. And incidentally, even if you look at residential property over a 10-year time horizon, Melbourne and Sydney have been the best places to have bought a place 10 years ago. And it was certainly better, incidentally, 10 years ago. If you were going to buy a house somewhere, you should have bought in a capital city and not outside the capital cities. As you can see, the regional areas have done very poorly. Now, just the whole issue, how often can you pick up a paper or read online or whatever, some story which says, when the property bubble bursts later this year? Those stories begin with an assumption that there is a property price bubble. I don't think there is. I know there's some pockets of overbuilding in the Melbourne CBD and the Brisbane CBD and Perth and Darwin where there will be some short-term weakness, but that is not a systemic across-the-nation housing bubble. There simply isn't one. But the bubblers won't give up. The bubblers, and I did this last year, the bubblers basically calculate how many years' income it takes you to buy a house. And then they say two things. Number one, it's a lot higher than it used to be. Absolutely correct. Number two, it's a lot higher than anywhere else in the world. Absolutely false. If you want to make such a comparison, go to a reputable international organisation. In this case, the OECD. And that's what you get. Australia's the green line. Find it. It has gone up from a bit more than 33 years ago, to almost 5. Now it's higher in the capital cities and it's higher again in Sydney. And incidentally, I saw some figures yesterday for China, which says basically in China, it's the depending on whether you're in a tier 1, a tier 2 or a tier 3 city, it costs you like anywhere between 12 and 35 years income to buy a house or to buy a unit. So if you think we've got a housing affordability problem, pity them. We've had a lot of company. The ratio's gone up in a lot of places, and my single biggest reason for that is that debt is so much cheaper, and so people load up on it. And for an individual household, they'd say, well, I have to take on more debt if I want to buy that house. But when everybody can and does take on more debt, that is what pushes prices up. Incidentally, I'm going to take the green line, isolate it, redraw it so that its long-run average is 100, and this must be the bubbler's favourite chart, because this says that if we're going to get back to the long-run average, house prices in Australia would have to fall by about 20%, or go nowhere and wait for an income to rise by 25%. I've dropped that line down there because I actually think it's partly cheaper debt, but it's also partly the capital gains tax discount that has pushed up prices, because that is what made negative gearing so attractive. And you can actually show that if you go to the ATO records and look to the left of this line, so earlier than 2000, the net gains and losses made from investment in residential property were very close to zero across the entire universe of taxpayers. To the right, there have been massive negative losses. And incidentally, you don't tell the true story about negative gearing if you count the number of people who negative gear and say most of these people earn less than $80,000. What you have to do is look at basically the dollars of negative gearing concessions, if you like, and they accrue massively at the top end. As simple as that. Here, as I said, the mood of the investor had basically turned tail in the past year. A year ago, this is what was going on. The credit borrowed by investors to purchase residential property was growing at more than 10% a year. Now, thanks to APRA, and thanks also to a bit of reclassification, that number's come all the way down to 5, and the owner-occupier seems to have picked it up. Now, bear in mind, these are people who borrowed from domestic institutions, so they're almost certainly domestic investors rather than foreign investors. And where have they been investing? This is a 12-month rolling sum of investor loans by state. Is there any particular line here that stands out for you? I'll put it to you, New South Wales. The investor boom in housing has been massively led by New South Wales. Now, coming to the long term, I've gone back to the consensus forecasters and said, don't tell me about this year or next, tell me about the next 10. Who's going to grow and who's not, and they've said, and the message was the same last year, put Australia at the top of the list. We expect to outgrow every other country on this list. So this remains not a bad place to live and work and invest. But of course, the more important growth stories are to our north. You should not be surprised to see India's growth prospects higher than China. You might be surprised at the margin. Australia, incidentally, a year ago, I think we were fourth from the bottom, maybe third from the bottom. We've moved up. So that's good news, isn't it? That's the good news. Here's the bad news. We're moving up this table using the Stephen Bradbury method. We've basically stayed upright and everybody else is falling back. We now expected to outgrow a number of relatively high income Asian countries. Now, in summary then, I actually didn't talk about this. As of Monday, Janet Yellen, the head of the Federal Reserve, pretty much said they're not going to raise rates in June or July, but she still thinks there's another one coming at some stage. Certainly the US isn't going to raise rates quickly enough to perturb markets. If they do continue to raise rates, they will be the first developed country that has successfully raised rates and kept them up since the GFC. A lot of other countries tried, including Australia, and we had to give up and go back and down. I actually didn't talk about this either. I hope Tim will agree with me on this. The Chinese share market is a casino. I don't know why anybody pays any attention to it. Did talk about this. We're desperately seeking a pickup in non-mining capex. Cash rate change is likely to may well fall again. The exchange rate's now close to fair value. And the Australian share market is cheap when compared with other forms of investment. Now, as you know, I always have a most important message, which I'll leave to the very end. But even before we get to that, I just thought I would acknowledge this is my sixth and last such presentation. So cartooning is one of my supplementary skills. So there's me saying goodbye. And this is the most important message right here. So I'll stop there.